He's wearing a Roddy Collins jacket. He's got his teeth done like Ross from Friends. He's looking magnificent, and he's ready to go.
Just for the pod, lads.
Just for the pod.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Now, great to welcome to the show, Mr. Gabriele Mercati. Hello, Gab. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
So, can we just start off? I know we're going to get into the financial chicanery or accusations of at Juventus and across Italian football in a moment, but just on foot of Liverpool cruising against AC Milan yesterday evening at the San Siro, it has prompted more discussions, I think, about the extent of English dominance in Europe at the moment. They were 2-1 winners. They've made it 6-6 in that particular group. To be fair, AC Milan were missing two of their back four last night and three of their first team players, but they didn't do particularly well in this group stage. English dominance in Europe, discuss, is this still feel in keeping with the various cycles that we've seen in Europe over the last 20, 30 years? Or do you think this is a more sustained separation?
Well, as we're recording this, Zenit have just equalized against Chelsea, and as it stands, Chelsea are finishing second in the group, so take that under advisement.
Mm-hmm. That's Chelsea, who were in the Champions League final last year and beat Manchester City.
Yeah, and who might be finishing behind Juventus, who are seventh in Serie A in the group. So, but, you know, look,
Sorry, you've raised a great point. For every question I'm going to ask here, there will be 10 contradictions or holes in it. So it's not, this is not a perfect science.
No, I completely agree with you. And if there's something that really annoys me is when people, like, you know, jump out and they talk about, based on one season, the decline of this and the rise of that. And we always get it after World Cups normally when, you know, you have a root and branch review and other nonsense because, you know, it's usually England got knocked out in the round of 16 or whatever. Look, I think making distinctions between leagues in some ways is pretty silly, right? I think right now, obviously the financial climate is different in some of these leagues, but, you know, there's no reason why Bayern, Juventus, Real Madrid, Paris Saint-Germain shouldn't be competing with the four really big clubs by turnover in the Premier League. And the reality is they're not, with the exception of Bayern, perhaps. And I think that's reflective of something. I think it's probably largely, you know, obviously there's a financial component to it, but like I said, these other clubs have the turnover, they have the resources to compete with the top English clubs. It's not some sort of Premier League stardust. It's Liverpool and City and Chelsea are really, really good, and they have a really, really high turnover. In the case of Liverpool and City, you've got two of the greatest managers in the world right now who've been in their jobs for 4 or 5 years, who've got a tremendous amount of control and input, and they've been basically able to really mold their clubs to their likeness. I don't think that's a coincidence. So three of the very best teams in club football right now are from the Premier League. Although, as it stands, one of them will finish second in the group behind Juventus, who are not in the Champions League places in Serie A. Just pointing that out.
Yeah. I know. I can't work out if it's dominant. It's certainly a very good period, but dominant feels like a stretch. So just to remind everyone, last year we had Chelsea and Man City, Champions League finalists. We had Bayern PSG the year before that. Then it was Liverpool Spurs. So you could start to make the argument, geez, of the last six finalists in the Champions League, four of them English. But then you're straight into four Real Madrid titles out of five and the other one being Barcelona. And the year before that, it's Bayern against Dortmund in 2013. Previous English winners, Chelsea, when they beat Bayern in 12. So you could very quickly be saying, yes, there is clearly concentration of money and billionaire owners and the best players and the best managers in England. At the same time, if Barcelona and Real Madrid hadn't made a complete mess of the last number of years, then things would be looking kind of largely okay, and you throw PSG into the mix and it would still feel relatively competitive. Like, it does feel maybe to an extent like it's just the fact that Real Madrid and Barcelona have almost overnight, in some respects, disappeared off the scene, which exacerbates this sense of doom.
If I take a step back, and by the way, Chelsea are now losing 2-1.
We're writing off Chelsea. They're nobodies.
I'd be really cautious in saying Real Madrid have disappeared off the scene. They have a huge league. atop of La Liga. They, you know, they've won their Champions League group, although they got thoroughly outplayed, I thought, by Inter last night. They still have a ton of quality. They've got a manager who's obviously nobody's won more Champions League titles than he has. So, yeah, I'd be kind of cautious about that. And they're in an okay financial position to the point that, you know, next summer they'll have a whole load of money to sign a lot of those sort of top free agents that are likely to be out there, starting with Kylian Mbappe. So
well, that's a fair point.
Rumors of Real Madrid's demise are a little bit exaggerated.
Are they? Yeah, okay. Because where we last really did a deep dive in where Madrid were was when they were at the point of trying to offload the likes of Varane on the cheap because they needed every cent they could possibly get their hands on. So it's not as bad, clearly, then as those reports suggest. Why will they have oodles of money next year, for instance?
Well, they're going to have loads of money because Gareth Bale will go park his backside on some golf course somewhere and, you know, go away. That will free up a whole load of cash. I think that's the big one. I mean, you know, again, when it comes to people talking about wages, it's very easy to kind of forget, you know, these numbers are so big. Are they real? Are they not real? But, you know, there is some basis to these numbers. And in the case of Gareth Bale, you know, this is one of the top five highest paid players in the world. And he's always injured or on loan to Spurs. So I think that's part of it. They should also have more money because they've invested heavily in the renovation and expansion of the Bernabeu, which should allow them to generate more revenue. I think, look, Real Madrid, I think, are in a good place.
Okay, sold on that. You've made a convincing argument there. So suddenly Real Madrid are back at the table.
I think they're back at the table. And I think City will be there because I assume Pep's going to stick around. My one question is going to be, is this going to be Liverpool? Where are they? Just simply because obviously you've got a bunch of stars on you know, whose contracts all expire at the same time in Mo Salah, Sadio Mane, and Roberto Firmino. And you've got a lot of players who are, you know, going to be over 30 or on the cusp of 30. Those three guys. Jordan Henderson, Thiago Alcantara is getting there, Virgil van Dijk. Liverpool have been very, very smart about how they've gone about this in the past, and they've done an excellent job, and they've managed to do it without slowing down. They're losing an important piece, I think, in Michael Edwards, who, you know, was whatever his title was, sporting director, director of football, may make a difference. But he's kind of the guy who sort of, you know, was the link between the money men and the scouts and the first team and Klopp and so ever and the analytics people. Very, very smart guy. So, you know, they're going to have to respond to that, and we'll see how they do that. But yeah, I would expect Real Madrid to be back in the mix, certainly, maybe even this season, not just next season.
So then how do you position English clubs and their quote-unquote dominance, to continue the theme maybe of how I kicked off the discussion, in Europe? It's obviously a good period for them, but do you think it's becoming in any way a touch unhealthy for the competition, or just one of those cycles?
I think it's just one of those cycles, to be honest. I don't, you know, people go back and you look at, you know, when we talk about one league versus the other, it's always like, what do you measure, right? If you, you know, are you measuring the top team? Are you measuring the top four teams in the Champions League? Are you measuring the top 10 teams? If you look at the record of Spanish clubs in the Europa League, for example, what does that say about strength and depth? And you can say, well, I only care about the top teams. Well, fine. But at the same time, these other teams who are maybe number 5, 6, 7, 8 in your league, those teams that go on to win the Europa League and are really good, those are the teams that, you know, Real Madrid and Barcelona in their day are measuring themselves against, right? You know, whereas if you're Liverpool and Man City, not so much this year, but, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, how often were they actually tested by the rest of the league? It's always a good indicator if you look at points totals. We've had a COVID-affected situation, but in years past, you know, we had 4 or 5 years where people were winning the league with 90 points or more. That never used to happen. I mean, literally hardly ever used to happen. And it's not just in England, it's elsewhere too. There's this level of polarization. And I think, you know, I think that kind of speaks into, or that speaks to the strengths of leagues as well.
I suppose what maybe initiated the conversation, even in just the last 24 hours, was that there was something quite jarring about watching second-string Liverpool team with nothing to play for go to the San Siro and beat Milan.
Like, I mean, yeah, I watched that too. I watched Jake afterwards creaming himself before he went over to the cricket and whatever. And then, you know, Michael Owen. What do you want me to tell you? Liverpool are a lot better side than Milan right now. Yeah, Liverpool rested 8 starters. Milan had 8 players out through injury. 8. Not 1, not 2, not 3, not 4. They had 8 players who likely would have started this game who were out because of injury. They had an impossible task to begin with in the sense that they didn't control their own destiny. You know, if Milan had won that game, it wouldn't have mattered because they still would be going out. Liverpool aren't just a little better. They're a lot better. Mm. And also, on top of that, in some ways, unfortunately for Milan, their players that were out were the ones who were least suited to playing, to facing Liverpool, you know, facing a defense with, you know, Tsimikas and Nico Williams were obviously less tested because against Liverpool's press, you know, you like having the alternative of the ball over the top for your pacey striker. Well, the one Milan striker who was not injured happened to be Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who's wonderful and great, but who's also 40 years old and isn't going to be fast. So, you know, they kind of lost that aspect of it as well. Mm. So yeah, look, if you want to, you know, go and have a knee-jerk circle jerk over this, sure, go ahead. You know, they're very good at that. But I think it's a lot simpler. You have 3 outstanding English teams, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You have Manchester United, who are not outstanding. They have some outstanding players, many of them injured. I know they've won the group. I think it's more of a quirk and more, you know, Ronaldo last-minute heroics that it's happened. I don't think United are anywhere near the level of the top 3 as of right now. Maybe 3-4 months of Rangnick, who knows? Mm. But yeah, you have 3 outstanding teams, and I think Bayern are an outstanding team as well, and I think Real Madrid are close to them. And Paris Saint-Germain, I still wouldn't want to face them in the knockouts because they have a shutdown goalkeeper or 2 shutdown goalkeepers potentially, and they've a ton of experience in this competition, and they have, you know, 3 of the greatest players in history who can create out of nothing, and then you've got no answers.
Yeah.
So I think that is the competition. You know, that is, those are the core 6 teams who I would place ahead of everybody else in the Champions League.
And to be fair, that kind of a dynamic, that isn't a major departure with anything that we've seen over the last 10, 15 years. That number of teams with legitimate chances to win, I think that's healthy enough for a competition, because there's a lot of doomsday talk about European football right now.
Yeah, I think so too. Look, people love taking like a small sample and jumping to massive conclusions, you know. I mean, I think, in fact, if anything, I think I'm right in saying this. You know, in other years, there was a guy, 2 years ago, like there was this ranking where like the, you know, the top 2 teams by wage bill in every single Champions League group were the 2 teams that advanced. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? It's not happening this year. It's not working out that way this year, you know. So, should that be a good thing? Should we highlight that perhaps instead of, you know, the preponderance of money? Should we highlight the fact that it may be a good thing that Barcelona goes out? It hasn't happened yet. They may still win in Munich as we record this, but you know, it's. I think this is a lot more complex than that.
And I mean, sorry to throw this one on you. So, in so much as you can reach for information to hand, Bayern, in many ways, impressively keep pace with the oil state clubs and with the Madrids and the Barcelonas over the last number of years. I mean, they pop up. 2 Champions League wins in the last 8 years is a very healthy return. They were in the final the year before, so it could have been 3 in 10 years, and they've won, what, the last... Is it the last 12 Bundesliga? I mean, that's not great for German football. Every title since 2008, yeah. So in Germany, it's utter and total dominance. Why? What is it about Bayern that manages to keep pace with the riches in England and the spending and the kind of generational talents that were at Barcelona and Real Madrid?
I think it's very simple. Germany's the biggest economy in Europe, not just by a little, by a lot. Munich is a ridiculously wealthy city, far wealthier than Liverpool and Manchester. Mm. You've got German industrial giants signing massive sponsorship deals. For all this talk of commercialization and globalization and the lucrative Asian markets and whatever, you know, stupid buzzwords these people come up with. Your bread and butter is your local fans.
Yeah.
That's where you make the bulk of your domestic commercial income, which is still hugely important. Your domestic TV income, which is still hugely important. And your domestic gate receipts. So when you go to Bayern, you know, I've had the opportunity to do, they're very proud of the fact, right, that they have kind of this three-pronged strategy in how they sell season tickets or how they sell tickets to their fans. On the one hand, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it gives you an idea, right? So it's going to be like 30%, 200 euros a year, you know, cheap as chips for the hardcore working class traditional Bayern fan, the guy you see behind the goal screaming for 90 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. Then they reserve another 30% that they don't sell as season tickets. That they sell these to, for example, you know, so that everybody who's a club member at Bayern, every traveling Bayern fan from other parts of Germany, other parts of the world, who wants to buy a ticket to see Bayern Munich once or twice a year can do it. It's a bit like the Norwegians and the Irish who come over once a year to Old Trafford, right? And then they have another 30%, which goes to all the rich people in Munich and the rich corporates in Munich. And these are people who will spend like 300, 400, 500 euros, sometimes several thousand euros on a corporate ticket where, you know, they give them a three-course meal, but it's Germany, right? So the three-course meal is probably bratwurst and sauerkraut and stuff like that, maybe some apple pie if you're lucky. And they give you some beer and you pay $2,000 for the privilege. That's how they hit the three segments, and that's how they make so much money in stadium revenue. It's very difficult for teams in other cities to be able to do that, even equally prestigious teams and whatever else. Throw in the fact that, you know, they have so much money that they hoover up the best talent in Germany from the other clubs. And I think, you know, a lot of people say, ooh, is this a problem for the Bundesliga? On the one hand, I think viewed from the outside, the competitiveness, yeah, it is a problem, right? It is a problem that Leipzig are knocking on the door and then Bayern just come and spend 25 million. And, you know, they take their defensive leader, they take their leader in midfield, and they take their manager all in one summer, right? And that's crazy. That's wild. Where else do we see that happening? On the other hand, look at the attendances in Germany. They have the highest attendances in Europe. They're the most stable league financially in Europe. And I get the impression that German fans don't really care so much. They're not really bothered. You know, when you see Hamburg and Schalke in the second division and they're getting 60,000 fans a game, and, you know, they're not going to win the Bundesliga, they don't particularly care. They just want to go and support their team and get excited and whatever else. I don't think they're as fussed by Bayern's dominance as we would be in other countries.
Okay.
And I find it weird, but hey, it's Germany. It's supposed to be weird and different from the rest of us, right?
So we've got the English clubs, which we're all familiar with and understand, doing their thing, and the Asian market is contributing TV money to their coffers along with billionaire owners. We've got PSG. We understand that's its own weird ecosystem. You've mentioned Bayern there. We've got the Spanish clubs, maybe Real Madrid, not in the dire straits that Barcelona are, but having a period of transition. And that brings us to Italy. So where are Italy?
I think we're in a lot better position in Italy than we were 5 or 10 years ago. We're in a better position because top to bottom, we have better owners. We have, I'm going to come out and say it. We have less dodgepot owners. Another one got arrested the other day, Ferrero, the Sampdoria president. We have owners who think like businessmen and who kind of get that, who don't take shortcuts. Now, we haven't reached critical mass there in Italy yet, unfortunately. But I think the football's better. It's more attacking. It's more, there's more uncertainty out there. So I think overall they're in a good place. Where they're in a bad place is, of course, you know, they're coming from a very low position, which is why Italian football right now, in many ways, is still behind, still further back than it should be. Not obviously relative to the Premier League, which is kind of its own thing, but in many ways relative to La Liga and relative to the Bundesliga as well. So I think that's still going to take some time to fix, but, you know, at least the direction of travel after years of treading water or just sinking is a positive one, in my opinion.
Okay. For those listening who aren't following it that closely, the latest, AC Milan are top of the table, Inter a point behind them. We have Napoli third, Atalanta fourth, Juventus fifth, Juve obviously off the back of 9 titles in a row, and Inter won last year. So are any of those going to emerge and be dominant, do you suspect, over the next decade and challenging for Champions League honours? Too difficult to tell, or do you think it might be chaotic enough in its own interesting way, and we might have different winners over the next decade?
So I think different things have derailed the situation. In Inter's case, it's certainly the fact that their owner, the Zhang family from China, they ran into a massive problem, which was that partly because of COVID, partly because of other reasons, and this is one of the richest men in China, they suffered a lot of, they had a whole retail chain and stuff, and Chinese government tapped them on the shoulder and said, okay, you guys are in trouble, you guys need help, you're going to sell X percent of your company to the government, you're going to sell Y percent of your company to this guy who was your competitor, but we think you should really, it'd be a good idea if you merged, and you're going to stop, you know, spending money on stupid stuff and trying to be a global brand, and enough of these losses at Inter Milan, right? So that left them in a really, really horrible position. I think they were already going to be in a tough position anyway, because they had spent more than they probably could have afforded without taking some risk, but this made it worse. And that's why Conte left, that's why Lukaku left, that's why Ashraf Hakimi left. So that remains to be seen. If they get an owner who's liquid, at least, who can keep them ticking over, I think they're in a pretty good position to be competitive. Milan are the interesting ones because obviously they were bought as a distressed asset by a hedge fund, Elliott. But I think these guys look at it, and then their plan originally, and it may still be their plan, was say like, all right, you know, we bought these guys, or in the end it cost us like $350 million to acquire this club. We've put in another, I don't know, $200-300 million and investments over the years. Let's get this club to $1 billion, let's say, or $1.5 billion. And then we sold them and we 3x'd our investment, right? That's how these people think. They're on their way to doing that. They may want to stick around if they can make it profitable. You know, they're trying to build a new stadium that they own together with Inter to replace the iconic San Siro. If they do that, obviously they're going to have something that Italian clubs for different reasons haven't really had. Which is stadium and match day revenue, which is obviously a huge driver. Every other top league in Europe, you've got clubs owning their stadiums, being able to control that side of things. In Italy, we have it for many different reasons until very recently. So yeah, they could be, I think they certainly could be competitive. Juve are a slightly different boat. I think there's deeper issues at that club, but it's hard also not to imagine them coming back. As for Atalanta, I'm posing no limits on those guys. Those guys have stardust. There's no telling what you're going to get from them.
Okay. On to Juventus then. So I've been doing a bit of reading about this. This is quite dense. There's talk that this could be the biggest football Italian scandal since Calciopoli back in 06 when they were relegated to Serie B. I don't know how true that is. It relates to their transfer policy, 60 plus transfers we could be talking about here. So reading that last year, this is a Serie A practice, as it is across Europe, to make money in capital gains, as in to make profits on your transfers. Issues arise, obviously, if you inflate the value of players. I was watching Philadelphia again recently, Gab, and Denzel Washington in a tour de force will often turn to Tom Hanks and say, explain this to me like I'm a 5-year-old. So, without further ado.
Okay. So, what we're talking about is player trading. Every club in Europe does it. And it's a way of making money. And it's based on a very simple accounting principle, which is that when I sell a player, let's say I sell a player for 20 million, I can book that 20 million as profit immediately in this year's accounts. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I buy a player for 20 million, and say give him a 5-year contract, then I book a 4 million charge or 4 million loss, if you will, every year for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
So, for example, let's pretend you and I are both Serie B clubs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I sell you a player for 10 million and you sell me a player for 10 million. We don't actually give each other €1, but what will happen is, let's say they're both players from the youth team. So the value on their books, the residual value on our books would be zero because it can cost us anything to get them.
Mm-hmm.
So we can both book a €10 profit on the sale of that player. And then we give these two players, say, 5-year contracts. Well, it's only costing us $2 million a year. So we've effectively generated $8 million out of thin air this season.
Yeah.
One example that everybody cites was when Juventus and Barcelona swapped Arthur for Pjanic, which I think is one of the, I believe is one of the deals that's being investigated. I don't remember the exact numbers, but off of the top of my head, I think one was 55 million plus bonuses. The other one was 65 million. Essentially, you're swapping these guys, right? You could have made them 100 million. You could have made one 100 million or 110 million if you wanted to. It didn't really make a difference, right? You're assigning a number to it that's supposed to reflect the transfer value, but which is just clearly quite arbitrary. We saw this with Manchester City and Juventus when they swapped Danilo for João Cancelo. Again, how do they come to those valuations? Nobody knows. Where it's become an issue for Juve is, you know, you can push the envelope on this and pretend, but there's two elements to this. One is, obviously, this money still goes on your balance sheet, right? So you're kind of kicking this debt, you're kind of kicking this obligation down the road, because in our original example of the 10 million swap, there's 2 million a year. Well, I got to pay another 2 million next year, right? For a player who might be rubbish, who I don't want. But the other thing is, there is some tolerance, but it still has to be grounded in reality. And in Juve's case, the allegation is that, you know, some of these guys who were getting 10 million, 8 million, 20 million valuations are players from the youth team, are players who, you know, are like 20, 21 years old and are going nowhere and have been on loan in the third division. It's very difficult to prove that a law, that the letter of the law was broken. I think it's pretty obvious the spirit of the law was broken.
Okay.
And in Juve's case, it's all magnified by one other fact, that this is a club that's listed on the sporting on the stock exchange, so they're held to a higher standard of reporting than other clubs. All that said, I have to say this, and I'm going to say this in Juve's defense: Juve haven't really said anything about this. All we've had so far are leaks from the prosecutor's office, including leaks regarding a mysterious sort of private contract that Cristiano Ronaldo signed, which has gone missing and nobody can seem to find it. We don't know if it exists or not. I think if you're Juve, all you can do is just be quiet, absorb all these leaks, which really should not be happening, and then defend yourself in court. And if you have a valid argument, then you're going to win.
Okay. Well, we'll watch this space. Gab Marcotti, super to have you on. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
No, it was great. Gabriele Marcotti there. And our football coverage is brought to you by Sky. You can watch every UEFA Champions League and Europa League match live on BT Sport this season.